government, if it's classified as protected information under this rule. With repeal of the rule, that could lead to the expansion of some of these surveillance programs.
We have to leave it there. Laura Moy, thanks so much for joining us from the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. The screening is Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. Gaining Ground is a film about growing food, empowering communities, and changing lives. It also addresses the negative impacts of industrial agriculture and genetically modified foods. It is an intimate view of rural and urban farmers embracing challenges. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 934 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KBOO 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboo AIR 2017.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Iranian visitor with a valid visa was detained by border agents at Portland International Airport yesterday.
The Oregon House has passed an enhanced Equal Pay Act.
And the Elliott State Forest may remain in public hands after all.
This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Iranian Alia Gandhi was granted a tourist visa to visit her sister here in Oregon, but that did not prevent her from being detained upon her arrival yesterday at Portland International Airport. Gandhi was taken into custody by agents of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection and transported to a detention center in the Dalles, where she was held overnight. According to a statement by the Border Patrol, a valid visa does not guarantee admission into the United States, and that visitors can be detained for a variety of reasons. Aliyah's sister, Layla Arjani, believes that her sister got nervous during questioning by customs agents at PDX and froze up. It's been reported that Aliyah had been arrested multiple times in Iran for not wearing a headscarf and was reportedly suffering from PTSD as a result. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Layla Arjani at PDX as well as demonstrators who were there to show their support for Aliyah.
My sister got a visa, a tourist visa, and she was planning to visit me and her sister and my kids and family for 4 weeks. She arrived yesterday at PDX. We came to pick her up, and then she was denied entry. We found out that she was taken to the NORCOR facility overnight, and she should be back here at the airport by this morning to be sent back at 1:24 with the next flight back to Iran.
And what reason did they give?
Not much. Through a lawyer able to talk to her yesterday night, I asked her. She said nothing happened. I don't know why. To one lawyer, they said she has her documents with her, her ID, the documents she took for the visa appointment. She just took them with herself. She thought maybe they would need it here again. So they got suspicious.
Tell us, our listeners, what brings you out here today?
Well, I just think it's absolutely awful the way that they're being treated. The fact that she was coming here legally to visit her legal U.S. citizen sister, and you know, for her to be treated this way, I mean, what other assumption can I make other than it's because of where she's from?
And what brought you out? How did you find out that this was going on?
Well, I found out last night when it was flying around all over Facebook. But I'm an activist in many circles. So, you know, there were a lot of people calling for action, immediate action, and saying, you know, come to the airport and support this family who is, you know, just here waiting and trying to get their sister and not really knowing what to do. And I just really felt like the more people that were here, both in support of them and also as a show of solidarity for media purposes, would be, you know, the more the better.
So tell us about what happened last night when you and others found out that Alia was being detained.
So I found out Alia was being detained, so we came to the airport to try to lend support for her, to have access to her attorneys that had come here to try to help her. And then it became aware to us that she had been transported to jail in the Dalles, an hour and a half away, driving in the middle of nowhere. So we just felt compelled to go to the jail and try to show support. If that happened to me, I wouldn't want to be alone and feel so afraid.
Oh, were you able to communicate in any way with her?
No, we tried to utilize the buzzer for the guard, and he would not confirm or deny that she was there. And then we asked to send a message of support to her. Please tell her that there are people here that are supporting her, and they said they were not available to pass on information.
Initial indications were that Alia Gandhi was to be placed on today's 1:30 flight to Amsterdam, but the latest reports are that she has been transported to the ICE Detention Center in Tacoma.
Today's city council meeting was uncharacteristically calm. Of course, that may have something to do with the fact that protesters were locked out. The 2 p.m. start was delayed for an hour as chanting protesters crowded around the entrance to the Portland building. Demonstrators told potential attendees that, quote, "They're not letting us in, so you can't get in either." City officials used the room's 182-person seating capacity as a means to control admission, resulting in very few non-city employees and only a limited number of journalists being able to attend. The change in security comes after Mayor Ted Wheeler promised to have anyone who disrupts the meeting arrested if they refuse to leave when asked to. Wheeler's hardened stance came after weeks of protests, which often resulted in meetings being closed and citizens who had signed up to testify being unable to do so. After last week's meeting, which was especially chaotic, Commissioner Nick Fish advised his staff to stop coming to city council meetings until it was safe to do so.
The Oregon House has passed a bill to strengthen the state's equal pay laws. House Bill 2005 prohibits employers from paying people less based on race, color, religion, gender, sexual orientation, national origin, marital status, disability, or age. The bill expands the state's existing pay parity laws and increases the penalties on companies that break them. The proposed law would also prevent employers from basing a new hire's compensation on their old salary, and would prevent employers from firing workers for asking what their colleagues are paid or for filing an equal pay complaint. The bill, which was sponsored by Lake Oswego Democrat Ann Lininger, specifies that an employee that's been discriminated against has the right to a jury trial as well as compensatory and punitive damages. Republicans expressed concern about the potential budget impact and proposed a watered-down alternative, but the bill was passed 36-24. The only Republican to vote in favor was Representative Rich Veal of Shoals. The bill now goes to the state Senate.
The Trump administration has proposed eliminating all funding for the National Endowment of the Arts. This means that fewer students in Oregon will get to experience the theater at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and it could also hurt the town of Ashland, where the festival is held. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has this report.
The proposed budget for the Trump administration would slash funding for the National Endowment for the Arts to zero, and that could mean fewer children in Oregon will be exposed to art. The state's world-renowned Oregon Shakespeare Festival hosts hundreds of students each year because of more than $100,000 in grant money from the NEA. One of those is the Shakespeare in American Communities grant. Eddie Wallace of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival says that money is vital for giving students an experience of the theater.
It helps us give discounts that keep the tickets affordable for students to come and have often their first encounter with Shakespeare on stage.
Wallace says part of the grant money goes to the Balmer Project, which helps bring students from schools that are unable to afford the experience, even with a discount, and also gives students and teachers workshop opportunities. The White House says the cuts are necessary to eliminate wasteful spending in the budget and reduce the deficit. Congress must approve the budget, and it's likely there will be changes. The NEA says one-third of its budget goes towards serving low-income audiences, and that 40% of NEA-supported activities take place in high-poverty neighborhoods. Wallace says spring and fall are when the festival sees the most students, and in fact they make up a large chunk of the audience during those times. He says not only does the festival rely on their attendance, but the entire community of Ashland does.
We're all very interdependent on each other here in town. The student groups bring a lot of their food and gift-buying money to town and their presence, and it really makes the town hum.
Wallace says just as important is the inspirational experience children receive.
Some folks who have gone on to either become major contributors to the festival or even company members to the festival, they got the spark of live theater when they came on one of these trips.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The 82,500-acre Elliott State Forest in southwestern Oregon may well be staying in public hands. State Treasurer Tobias Reed, who last month cast the deciding vote to approve selling the forest to logging companies, announced yesterday that he sees a way for keeping the forest out of the hands of the lumber industry. Governor Brown, who originally had been in favor of selling the forest, changed her mind and announced her opposition to the sale in December, acknowledging the influence of protests by citizens and environmental groups. Treasurer Reed also mentioned public pressure as a factor in his change of mind. Governor Brown and key state lawmakers have proposed to float $100 million in bonds to buy out much of the Common School Fund's interest in the Elliott State Forest.
Tom Homan, the acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, faced an angry crowd in Sacramento yesterday. It was one of Homan's first town hall forums since being appointed the country's leading immigration enforcement official. Anna Tintakoulis of KQED has this report.
Large majorities of California voters support giving undocumented immigrants a pathway to citizenship and oppose constructing a border wall. How the state feels about sanctuary cities is a little more complicated. That's according to a poll released today by the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. Small majorities of voters either support or oppose sanctuary cities, depending on how the policy is framed in the question. Yesterday in Sacramento, the acting director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Tom Homan, got a taste of that division as he faced an angry crowd. It was one of Homan's first town hall forums since being appointed the country's leading immigration enforcement official. The California Report's Anna Tintakoulis was there.
That's the sound of angry protesters outside yesterday's town hall forum. Inside, more jeering crowds. Despite protesters screaming obscenities and calling him names, Homan tried to calm fears that ICE is now targeting so-called sensitive locations, places of worship, hospitals, and schools. He reiterated the top priority is deporting undocumented immigrants with criminal histories. That's why he says county jails and courthouses are not off limits.
Listen to me now. I don't want children not going to school. I don't want people not going to their doctor. I don't want people not going to church. That's why I'm explaining the way ICE conducts their operation in a target enforcement operation.
The event, put on by Sacramento County Sheriff Scott Jones, also got lawmakers like Senate President Kevin DeLeon to attend. Outside the town hall, he defended so-called sanctuary cities, which are refusing to cooperate with federal immigration agents.
Scores of cities and counties nationwide refuse to be strong-armed by the president. In California, we celebrate diversity. We don't ban it, we don't wall it off, and we don't deport it.
De Leon is pushing a bill that would make California a sanctuary state. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tintakoulis.
In this chapter of the Civil Liberties Minute, the ACLU's Bill Newman discusses the threat of President Trump's executive order overturning the Obama administration's climate change policies.
Trump's recent climate change executive order poses an existential threat to civil liberties. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The Trump administration has now, as a practical matter, embraced global warming as a goal, which is not surprising. After all, his head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, insists that human activity is not a primary contributor to global warming. And Pruitt's top aide makes the extraordinary claim that increased carbon emissions heating up the planet are good for the Earth. To be sure, all is not lost. Yet. The EPA might not be able to quickly reverse climate change regulations, and states like New York and California have vowed to fight for clean air and clean water and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the threat to civil liberties is enormous. The preamble to the Constitution of the United States says that our country was formed by we the people to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Posterity means future generations. But under Trump's plan, there may not be much posterity for whom we can preserve and protect the blessings of liberty.
And we've got to get ourselves back to the garden.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news from the BOO at 5:45, followed by Keeping It Real at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for early showers, followed by clearing and the possibility of afternoon sun. Temperatures will be in the mid-50s. East of the Cascades in Hood River, you can expect a sunny and windy day with similar temperatures. On this day in 1973, the last U.S. troops left South Vietnam. Up to that point, the Vietnam War was the longest and most unpopular foreign war in U.S. history. 58,000 Americans died, and as many as 2 million Vietnamese soldiers and civilians were killed. The quote of the day is from philosopher, essayist, and novelist George Santayana, who said, quote, "Only the dead have seen the end of war, and those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it."
You are listening to KBOO Evening News. This program has been made possible by KBOO members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a candidate forum for Portland Public School District Board candidates on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. This forum is in partnership with the Oregon Parent Teacher Association and Communities and Parents for Public Schools. More voter information at lwvpdx.org. And this KBOO program has also been made possible by through Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is succumbing to spring.
They say most dark clouds have silver linings, but what about orange clouds? Last week, the Republicans in Congress defeated their own health care bill. Yesterday, State Treasurer Toby Reed said he had changed his mind about the Elliott State Forest and will vote for it not to be privatized. Oregon is trees, of various kinds and sizes, glistening. Oregon is rivers, enthusiastic, seldom behaving as expected, a living landscape stretching out and changing for spring. We had more cold and ice this winter than ever. We can argue whether the darkest day was election, inauguration, or is yet to come. Wet and warmer, spring doesn't care about politics. Washington, D.C. is another planet to spring. The flowering street trees will soon drop their petals. Most won't bear fruit, yet they give us so much, sparking us to the outdoors to put our hands in the soils, real and metaphorical, and bring forth nourishment and strength. The surprising, encouraging light in the sky and in faces all around us. For spring and poetic justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Just 2 business days after failing to convince congressional Republicans to repeal and replace the nation's health care law, President Trump picked up the presidential pen to sign an executive order Tuesday aiming to make good on another pledge, a return to coal. FSRN's Nell Abram talks with Bob Keefe, Executive Director of Environmental Entrepreneurs, or E2, about what Trump's action means for efforts to address climate change and the future of the green energy sector.
The Clean Power Plan is the very foundation of U.S. efforts to combat climate change. Bob Keefe, what does the plan actually call for?
Thanks, Nell. So the Clean Power Plan effectively gives the foundation for states to cut their carbon emissions from existing power plants by about 30%. Now, there's basically 3 ways they can do that. Number one, they can clean up dirty power plants. Guess what? That creates jobs, drives economic growth. Number two, they can add more clean renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal. That creates jobs, drives economic growth. Number three, they can increase energy efficiency in their states, which creates jobs, drives economic growth. And also, by the way, saves consumers, businesses, governments, schools a lot of money. So we see the Clean Power Plan as not only the most important climate policy we've ever seen in this country, but a huge potential economic catalyst. And by rescinding that, President Trump has effectively kicked about 3 million clean energy workers right in the teeth and told them they don't care about their jobs.
You've gone right to one of the central points often used to justify support for controversial fossil fuel projects, job creation, jobs. How does the renewable energy industry compare with the fossil fuel sector in terms of employment opportunities?
E2 has followed and tracked clean energy job growth around the country for a number of years now, and we worked hard to produce a number of reports that goes really deep in states all around the country as to how many people work in these types of jobs. Our work, by the way, was recently picked up by the Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy is tracking this stuff now. And what DOE and what we have found, again, is that about 3 million people work in clean energy right now in every state in the country. These are folks that get up every single day and put on their boots and go manufacture and install solar panels, wind turbines. They go make Energy Star appliances. They go to auto factories and make cleaner vehicles and electric vehicles, whether it's in Tesla in Nevada or in Motor City in Detroit. These are folks that go into our schools, our offices, our homes, and make them more efficient through better lighting, better heating and air conditioning system, better windows, better insulation, things like that. 3 million jobs is a lot of people now. 3 million jobs, by comparison, the real estate industry in this country is smaller than that. The coal industry has about 75,000 workers. Now, everybody's job is important. Those coal workers' jobs are important. But this is the fastest growing industry in America, clean energy. There's lots of opportunities for coal workers and everybody else to move into these jobs. We need to figure out ways to do that. We don't need to ignore the 3 million people that already work in this industry.
How will Trump's move today impact the renewable energy sector?
Clean energy companies, just like any other company now, they rely on certainty to grow. They rely on certainty to keep people employed. They rely on certainty to make investments. What the Clean Power Plan did was essentially sent a clear market signal to American companies in the clean energy space and in the energy efficiency space that this is the way we're going. This is the way we're going, and by the way, this is the way the entire world is going when you see that just about every country in the world signed on to the Paris Climate Accord. What President Trump has just done is taken that certainty away from American businesses. They don't know where we're going to go next when it comes to clean energy. It's unfortunate. The good news is that there are states that are still moving forward. California is one of them, but also New York and North Carolina and Iowa, places all around the country where we have smart governors and smart legislatures that are doing the right thing and continuing to move forward on clean energy, even though we have this executive order from the president effectively sticking his head in the sand and saying that these clean energy jobs and this clean energy industry should be ignored.
Let's put dollars on it. What are the costs to consumers of pursuing fossil fuel energy sources versus the potential costs of a transition to green technologies?
Well, the costs are potentially staggering. You know, Citicorp came out with a report last year that estimated the world economy could lose $44 trillion in gross domestic product from climate change issues by 2060. That's huge. Companies realize this as well. If you look at companies like Google, Facebook, all of the big technology companies, they're going 100% renewables. Why? Because it's more efficient, it's certainly better for the environment, and it's better for our future, but they're doing it for bottom line reasons. You can get cheaper energy right now from renewable sources, wind, solar, et cetera, in some parts of the country, than you can ever get from coal. Coal's more expensive. Nuclear is way more expensive. Natural gas is more expensive in some of these areas. So you have places like I mentioned, Google, Facebook, and others that are going 100% renewable because it's a cheaper way to do business and it's the right thing to do.
Under an Obama-era rule, government agencies were required to factor in the social costs of carbon when considering proposed projects. What's the outlook for that rule, and how would lifting it affect the move toward renewable energy?
Well, apparently the Trump administration wants to get rid of that rule and get rid of any kind of rule that would have the federal government look at the cost of this stuff. That's just simply ridiculous. It would be like letting companies and others spew their garbage into the air or throw it out on the streets and not account for the cost of cleaning that up. Now, the biggest agency in the government is the U.S. military right now. The military has said that this is a huge cost. It's what the military calls a threat multiplier. The worse the climate gets, the more times we have to send our fighting men and women overseas to protect other countries. We have to deploy thousands of people every single day protecting the oil supplies out of the Straits of Hormuz. And as the costs of climate change continue to go up, we'll have to continue to deploy those folks in faraway lands to deal with things like humanitarian crises, to deal with things like drought and water shortages and other issues that come from climate change. It's a huge cost.
The U.S. was a leader in the efforts to reach agreement on the Paris Climate Accords. What does this move by the Trump administration say about both the U.S. commitment to that agreement and what impact do you think it has on other nations' willingness to stand by their commitments under the deal?
So I was in Paris with a number of our members and business people all around the world. The United States has always been a world leader on not just climate issues, but every issue, as we know. What this effectively does is said that the United States won't lead anymore. That's unfortunate. It's sad. People need to stand up. They need to speak out. They need to contact their lawmakers in Congress and say, this isn't what we want. Poll after poll after poll, as a matter of fact, has showed that Americans want clean energy. They want to get away from fossil fuels, not continue to remain shackled to fossil fuels, which is what this executive order would do. People need to stand up, they need to speak out, and they need to tell their lawmakers that this isn't what they want.
That's Bob Keefe, Executive Director of Environmental Entrepreneurs, or E2, a national nonpartisan group of business leaders, investors, and professionals who advocate for policies that are good for both the economy and the environment. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
Despite widespread popular outcry, the 15 Republican representatives voting against it, the House voted yesterday to strip citizens of their right to online privacy, selling out the American public to the deep-pocketed telecom industry. By repealing the FCC's privacy provision, Senate Joint Resolution 35 will allow internet service providers to gather all available information and sell it to whoever they want. An expected byproduct of the bill will be less regulation and monitoring of data users, making hacking, internet scams, and unauthorized monitoring of users even easier to commit. Nima Singh Giuliani, ACLU Legislative Counsel, said that it's extremely disappointing that Congress is sacrificing the privacy rights of Americans in the interest of protecting the profits of major internet companies. The bill has already passed the Senate and is expected to be signed soon by President Trump. In the wake of the action, a number of states have already indicated that they will attempt to step in and provide the protection that the federal government has removed.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Canada's Radio Labor reports that global unemployment is expected to continue to climb through 2017. International Labor Organization General Secretary Guy Ryder says that the trend is higher joblessness, mostly due to struggles in the emerging economies of the world.
I think the major message arising from our annual report on employment trends is that despite the marginal improvement in economic growth rates foreseen for 2017, this will be insufficient to prevent a continuing rise in global unemployment. We think 3.4 million will be added to the global unemployment figures in the coming year.
Ryder is the first unionist to head the ILO. He says not only are millions more going to be unemployed, but the quality of jobs being created isn't high enough to sustain higher living standards for workers.
Unfortunately, the trends that we see coming down the line mean that we will not make the progress that we must in continuing to eliminate working poverty. This is an unsatisfactory, unacceptable situation, but not an inevitability, and therefore we need to refocus on employment issues.
More than 100 institutional investors in the U.S. with a combined $3 trillion in assets under management want the Securities and Exchange Commission to continue to disclose CEO-to-worker pay ratios. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's a shame that the SEC is reconsidering its implementation of the worker pay ratio disclosure requirement. According to the AFL-CIO's Executive Pay Watch, CEO pay in the U.S. is 335 times the average non-supervisory worker's pay. Immigrants' rights groups on Tuesday delivered 11,000 petition signatures to Governor Cuomo calling for him to take action on behalf of immigrants. The groups want Cuomo to advance policies in New York to protect immigrant families in the face of Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. The immigrant rights groups have created an immigrant opportunity agenda of legislative proposals. The Liberty Act in New York would limit cooperation between immigration enforcement and state and local agencies. The International Union of Food Workers is urging Coca-Cola to stop harsh, blatantly anti-union practices at a bottling plant in Indonesia. The union says Coca-Cola management is well aware of what's happening and have the power to stop it. The Indonesian Coca-Cola bottler is trying to stamp out independent and democratic unions at the plant. When workers started organizing in 2015, management harassed union members, fired and suspended workers who support a union, and the bottler has so far refused to start negotiations with the workers on a collective bargaining agreement.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. The report focuses on how climate change is impacting listeners' lives. Climate Connections is a report that moves the climate change discussion away from simple debate to focus on how it's impacting listeners. Today we see how Sean Hulo Yoros's paintings reflect the urgency of climate change.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Balancing on a paddleboard, Sean Yoro weaves between Arctic ice floes. Cold water swirls around him as he searches for the perfect piece of ice. When he finds it, he hops on top, takes out brushes and paint, and quickly gets to work. Soon, the image of a woman's face emerges. It looks like she's asleep on the ice.
I've sacrificed so much for a lot of my pieces. I've been hurt on a lot of these projects, and it doesn't stray me far from my goal ever.
Yoro, who is also known as Hula, has combined his passions for art and surfing. From his board, he paints murals in hard-to-reach areas. He's painted on icebergs and ice floes in the Arctic. The art is fleeting. The woman's profile melted with the ice, but it speaks to the urgency of climate change.
You kind of felt a need to help her as she just melted into the water, so it was almost like she was drowning.
Few people will see his art, so he has a photographer document it.
I kind of got used to my pieces having this lifespan. It's almost a meditative thing where I'll create the piece and have it for that moment before I'll let it go.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Westinghouse, a company that has come to be better known for nuclear power plants than home appliances, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy today. As a subsidiary of Toshiba, Westinghouse is responsible for building more nuclear reactors worldwide than any other entity. Toshiba had recently announced its plans to withdraw from foreign construction projects, such as three new reactors in the UK at Moorside. The filing was sparked by huge losses stemming from Westinghouse's troubled nuclear construction projects in the American South, projects that is now in doubt. Greenpeace's Japan energy campaigner Ai Kashigawa said the bankruptcy underscores the global meltdown of the nuclear power industry. In 2015, an estimated 147 gigawatts of renewable power was added globally, compared to only 11 gigawatts for nuclear power in the same year.
While very few are surprised that profits for businesses like defense contractors and private prisons have increased since Trump's election, the new president has also improved business for makers of some birth control products and for Planned Parenthood. Fearing repeal of Obamacare, rising copays and shrinking access to abortion, an increasing number of women are opting for long-acting reversible contraceptions, or LARCs. LARCs include intrauterine devices and arm implants and prevent pregnancy for 3 to 12 years, or about 1 to 3 presidential terms. Shortly after the election, Planned Parenthood reported a 900% increase in birth control appointments scheduled. Many smaller clinics cannot afford to stock the devices and implants and must order them individually, causing significant delays for patients.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will visit Turkey Thursday. Tillerson is the most senior U.S. official to visit Turkey since the change of administrations. Relations between the two countries have been complicated in recent years, exacerbated by the civil war in neighboring Syria and Ankara's crackdowns on civil society following a failed coup attempt last summer. Hundreds of academics have been fired from universities across Turkey by a presidential decree, along with 4,500 public servants. It's the latest of a series of purges since the unsuccessful military overthrow attempt of July 15, 2016. In all, more than 125,000 people have been fired and 40,000 arrested in professions like the police, army, and judiciary. Lorena Rios reports that some fired professors are continuing to teach in the streets.
A group of university professors, teachers, and civil servants gather in the Educators Union in Ankara to discuss their future plans after losing their jobs in ongoing purges of public sector workers. After last year's failed coup, the administration of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan cracked down on opposition groups and critics, and Turkey's broad anti-terror laws are implemented at the expense of civil liberties, and in the case of professors, academic freedom. Nurbetul Çelik, a longtime professor at Ankara University, says the crackdown started before the coup attempt. In January of last year, more than 1,000 academics from 90 universities signed a petition calling for peace in southeastern Turkey, where confrontations between armed forces and Kurdish militants have displaced about 500,000 people. The government immediately raided the homes of some of the professors, and of the recent wave of mass firings, 115 of the academics signed the petition.
Since then, our projects would not be approved. We were prevented to go abroad for the conferences and seminars.
Didem Kalafat, a fourth-year student of sociology in Ankara University, is meeting her friends on a Sunday morning in a park on the outskirts of the city. They are here for what is known as Street Academy, an event organized by fired academics who teach in public spaces as a form of resistance. Her former professor, fired in the most recent purge, is giving a lecture on class struggle. Five academics from her department were dismissed, and two of her classes have been put on hold.
The professors who are still in the department took over classes that were taught by the dismissed academics, but they are not as good. We don't want a professor appointed by the government or by the Council of Higher Education.
Political science professor Mehmet Mutlu is one of the organizers of the Street Academy. He also signed the petition calling for peace in the southeast, but the government has not yet targeted academics from his institution.
They were under the pressure of the government and the High Council of Universities. And in my university, the Middle East Technical University has a long history of dissident. It's known as a leftist university, but that doesn't mean we are not under the risk. We are just waiting to be dismissed.
After the failed coup, Turkey's Higher Education Board demanded the resignation of 1,557 deans on duty at all private and state universities throughout the country. Some of them have been reinstated, but President Erdogan's direct appointment of university rectors, especially at the prestigious state-run Bosphorus University in Istanbul, has stirred controversy and sparked anger from its students.
I'm here to underline that that's not the problem of it's not just the problem of the dismissed academics, but also is the problem of the still working academics, because we are trying to teach under the pressure of the same government.
In Istanbul, Levant Dolek, a professor at Istanbul University's economics department, is also organizing with the Educators Union. He did not sign the petition calling for peace, but he considers himself a target for his political leanings.
The worst thing is we did not face any criminal charge. Our right of defense is totally usurped. The decree claims that we are connected with some terrorist groups, because, but they don't explain which group and how we are related. Nobody says pro-Kurdish or leftist group, no explanations.
Dolek is urging academics and civil servants who have been affected by the purges to organize through the union. Academics like Dolek are staging demonstrations and protests in front of their old university gates with the support of students. They risk violent police dispersals and detention, but at this point they have little left to lose.
They may fire us, but they couldn't silence us. So I can say that the future will be better and we will win.
Lorena Rios, FSRN, Istanbul.
Earlier today, British Prime Minister Theresa May officially began taking the steps necessary for the United Kingdom to exit the European Union, a process that has come to be known as Brexit. By signing a letter invoking Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, May started the process that will ultimately result in the removal of the UK from the 28-member European Trading Association. In a statement to Parliament, the Prime Minister said that it was, quote, the moment for the country to come together. By a narrow margin, British voters decided last summer to leave the EU, with English voters overcoming the strong objections of their Scottish and Northern Irish countrymen to provide the slim majority. British Labour leaders warned that Brexit would be a national failure if the government did not protect worker rights during the transition, and Scottish leaders have raised the idea of another separation referendum. Brexit supporters, on the other hand, praised the Prime Minister for sticking to her timetable to start the formal negotiations.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you would like to be a part of the KBOO News crew, call or stop by the station. We'd love to have you on the team. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Kanan Schlesinger, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is David Casters. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zalos Marchand, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, Joanne Hardesty speaks to a man who spent 7 years in jail, having never been convicted of any crime. His new book is called Justice Restored, 10 Steps to End Mass Incarceration in America. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, author Morgan Parker explores 21st century black womanhood in her new book, There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
That's right, it's 5:45 on a Wednesday, which means it is time once again for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of items of interest here at the station and in the greater listening community. We are joined once again by station manager Gil Cardone. Hello, Gil, how are you?
Good, Brian, how are you doing?
Great. You'll be telling us, I'm telling you right now, you will be telling us soon about stuff that's going on at the station. But first, we are also joined tonight by our Director of Underwriting, Matthew Bristow. Matthew, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you. How are you?
Great. So let us start with Matthew. Matthew, how long have you been here at KBOO?
Well, I first got involved about 18 years ago at this point, and along the way, I've done most of the things that a volunteer can do. That's anything from working at the front desk and doing dishes, tabling out at events, answering phones, of course, during membership drives, helping with filing. I was a programmer's assistant for a couple of shows many years ago. Many years on the board of directors. And I've always liked this segment, so I'm excited to be on it. So
how did you then transition into doing underwriting?
It was the timing of